thinking big thoughts so you don't have to.
Here we go.
Here's John Williams.
It's 108. It's WGN Radio. John Williams live in the Allstate Showcase Studio on Michigan Avenue. If you're just getting out of the Cubs game, today is Monday. My goodness. I tried to watch that thing and I decided I'm going to go to bed because I can't stay up past the 10th inning. And I knew it would end any moment now. Whenever I turn off the game, then it ends right away in some dramatic fashion. Well, guess who made the right call last night? In fact, I almost regretted the fact that when I got up this morning and saw that the game went 18 innings and set a record for most strikeouts, like that's a lot of fun to watch. I almost wish that I was there for it, but I'm not sure, given the outcome, that I would have been glad after 18 innings that I saw us lose 5-4 on a Starlin Castro ground out to short, of all things. 48 strikeouts is the record. You know, I'm looking at the box scores, and you didn't see them in the paper today because the paper, of course, went to bed before the game was over. And then online, I really haven't been able to find a box score that I like, for reasons that I can't explain. But I think there were 52 men left on base in that game last night, too. How is that not a record? I'm counting them up in this one column here, and I think it was we left 22 on base, and I think they left 30 on base. No, we left 30 on base, and they left 22. So 48 strikeouts, 52 left on base. I mean, if half of those runs scored, we would have put up 26. But no. One last note about last night's game. I don't know what is inside Anthony Rizzo's bones, but to get hit square on the arm, right on the bone, by Aroldis Chapman is something most of us would not survive. Holy cow, did that look painful. My wrist is sore today. I was just watching TV. Lost in all of this is Kyle Schwarber's catch down the left field line. If you haven't seen the video on that, he made one running catch in left field, which was kind of nice, and everybody likes to tell the story about big old Lummix Kyle Schwarber hitting under his average where he should be. Now he's getting hot, not a real good left fielder, and I guess he's not a great left fielder, but he made a couple nice plays yesterday, including one that was Derek Jeter-esque or Anthony Rizzo-ish, where he fell into the stands and did a flip catching a foul ball. So the Cubs lose. And I just got the Cubs on my mind besides that point, but the fact that Scott Simon, who wrote My Cubs, A Love Story, is going to be in our studio tomorrow. That's a really good book. Yeah, here's the rest of the box score. It's just been handed to me. And I think it's like 52 LOB, which is just amazing. Scott Simon's book, My Cubs, A Love Story, is really a really good book. And you can read it in an afternoon I did yesterday. He points this out. As much as you think about pre-2016, the futility that has been the Cubs over the years, if you think about that, you go 108 years, didn't win a World Series. And maybe you know this well because you're a Cubs fan. But he points out that the Cubs got into and lost six World Series between 1908 and 1945 in 37 years. We were in six World Series. To me, that's not a team cursed. That's a pretty good team. That's a great team. In every 6 or 7 years, for 37 years, we were in the World Series. We were the second best team in baseball. I mean, that's pretty good, don't you think? If I told you that, you'd say, wow, that's a good team. That was the Cubs, who went 108 without winning one. And in the course of the book, he begins to talk about how the Cubs lost over the years. Were they cursed or not? He kind of walks you through some of the famous stories. And he walks you through last year's World Series run. And then he just says some interesting things about baseball along the way. It's Scott Simon's My Cubs, A Love Story. Here's what he said about the 1969 Cubs and Mets, Ron Santo and the Black Cat. And I think this is interesting because what's lost, you say, well, the Cubs blew it, but the Mets were really dynamite that year. The Mets, with an amazing pitching staff, included Tom Seaver, Jerry Kuzman, and a young Nolan Ryan. Scary thought that. Caught the wind while the Cubs hobbled. The two teams were facing each other September 9th. Seaver on the mound in the second inning when a black cat walked past Ron Santo in the on-deck circle. It arched its back, Then the cat sauntered to the Cubs' dugout to hiss at Leo Durocher. "Can't blame a cat for that," Leo said later. The Mets won 7-1, and the Cubs never saw first place again. The New York Mets won their first World Series that year. Leo Durocher took up smoking again that night. He took a long drag in the dugout. The Cubs' equipment manager, Yash Kawano, told him, "Those things will kill you." Leo said, "Yep, that's the general idea." The Cubs were already in a nosedive in the summer of 1969. They did not need a black cat to cross their path. They didn't need to curse, and they didn't when they already had Durocher. His point was that Durocher used his starting nine way too much. He should have rested some of the players playing in the heat of day games. But no one ever claimed the small black cat at security after the game, and he was turned over to the city shelter that night. And then he writes about what happened in 2003. The Chicago Cubs were just 5 outs from going to the World Series. You know this story, don't you? In 2003, when Luis Castillo of the Florida Marlins sliced a short fly ball down the left field line, the Cubs were ahead 3-0, 3-2 in the 8th inning of Game 6 of the National League Championship Series. You still have to marvel at how close we were. Mark Pryor, Kerry Wood's slightly junior partner in the dreamy mound duo that sports writers called Chicago Heat, was working on a two-hit game. Scott Simon writes, Moises Alou, the Cubs' left fielder, leapt up and opened his glove to catch the ball just as it arrived in aisle 4, row 8, seat 16. 26-year-old man in glasses, a Cubs cap, and black Renegade sweatshirt for the youth baseball team that he coached also tried to catch the ball. The foul ball ended up bouncing around the seats, and Moises Alou slammed his mitt against his thigh. Mark Pryor pointed out the man under the headphones to the umpires to complain of fan interference. The video of that episode, it really wasn't a play, it was an episode, has been replayed frame by frame, and this is a tasteless analogy, I know, but it's true, almost as much as the Zapruder film. My wife and I were watching in a bar. I tried to look unshaken. "These things happen," I announced, while screaming inside like a lost little boy. "We're ahead," I said, "we'll be fine." Or whatever Rommel said just before the invasion of Normandy. Mark Pryor threw a wild pitch, and then Ivan Rodriguez singled home Juan Pierre. Then Miguel Cabrera hit a grounder to short that had double play written in red stitching across the seams. Alex Gonzalez, the fine young fielder, bobbled the ball. Derek Lee came up and slapped a double. Florida tied the score, and the chill began to move up my spine. Florida Marlins would go on to score 8 runs in the inning. They won the game 8-3. And then a little later on, he says this. The Chicago Cubs might have been in the World Series that year, but for that play. What if? But he says, I'm more intrigued by another question. What if Moises Alou had not slammed his mitt and skulked in a circle and then stalked back to left field? His show of fury made it look as if Steve Bartman had grabbed defeat from the jaws of victory over his glove. When you see the video, you begin to catch how Alou's reaction riled the crowd in Wrigley Field. And it's that reaction, then the sullen faces and smoldering quiet, that may have made young Cubs who thought that they didn't believe in the curse start to wonder, is this the scourge that I've heard so much about? There was also a worse ugliness that night, worse than the play. People in the stands began to chant a sing-song bleep, 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 bleep. A few people threw cups of beer. Bartman wiped suds from his eyes with the back of his hand, and he tried with great dignity to watch the game. Some of the shouts became truly vile, and a small chorus shouted, "We're gonna kill you." Bartman finally hung his coat over his head while 8 or more security guards tried to steer him through ranks of sputtering, spitting half-wits in Cub hats. It was disgraceful and sickening and should be especially so to Cub fans. That night, we did not deserve to get into the World Series. Of course, Governor Rod Blagojevich had one of the most shameless reactions. He said of Steve Bartman, quote, "The guy would never get a pardon from me," but former Governor Blagojevich is now in prison for trying to auction off the U.S. Senate seat once held by Barack Obama. He has more sympathy for pardons now. And finally, about this episode, he writes this. I do not believe in curses, but I like the idea of karma, or at least the notion that good acts can lead to good results and bad acts won't. The Chicago Cubs did not deserve, he writes, to be in the World Series in 2003 if they could not come back from a debacle that led to a breakdown and win Game 7. They did not deserve to be in the series that year because Sammy Sosa was in right field. He charmed and enthralled Cubs fans in the country with his home run records, and all the while he deceived us by using banned drugs and then lied about it like a politician under oath before the U.S. Congress. And they did not deserve to get into the World Series in 2003 because too many Cub fans ridiculed and threatened a good man just for behaving like a fan. In 2003, Cubs fans put a curse on their own team. And then he wondered out loud, well, in print, in his book, Scott Simon's My Cubs, A Love Story, he wondered, at the time it started to rain in Game 7, if, oh my God, this is so bizarre, this is our next black cat. You know how it turned out. He'll join us tomorrow. So there's still more crazy airline stories in the news. I just want to get to a couple of them. We're not going to open up the phones. We're not going to dwell on it. But I just want to sort of catch you up on where we are on all of these bizarre stories and update you with the latest, bizarrest of them all. Remember, in the 2 o'clock hour, Noam Levy, LA Times national healthcare policy reporter, talks to you and me about pre-existing conditions. Are we way overreacting? Or, in fact, is it going to be as onerous as some members of the media and Democrats make it sound, this pre-existing condition? Call this number, 312-981-7200, if you ever got on a flight going someplace you weren't going. Did you ever get on the wrong plane? The latest in a series of mishaps on airlines is that happened. A woman in New Jersey was supposed to go to France, and instead she went to San Francisco, which is lovely, but it's not France. And the way the story is being told is the airline put her on the wrong plane, or the airline sent her to San Francisco instead of France. No, she got on the wrong plane. If you get on a plane and when it opens up, they don't speak your native tongue, that's on you. That is your problem. It's sometimes complicated. They move gates. But if you get on an airplane and it goes to a city you're not going to, which is almost impossible to do, but if that happens, am I right about this? That's on you. I'll get to that in a second. But has anything close to that ever happened? I mean, if that's you, 312-981-7200. So here's where we are on the great airlines things. United Airline, Dr. David Dow, we all know that he got Corboy and Demetrio, the airline attorney specialists. And they've worked out a settlement that most of us believe is about $2 million, but we have no proof of that. The American Airlines, that was United. On American Airlines, you had the stroller video, the woman, the blonde-haired gal, crying because she had her twins, and she got into an argument with the staff, and then the one passenger was going to beat up the staff. She has also acquired the services of Demetrio, and that suit is pending, or a settlement is still awaiting. The Delta Airline family, this is the Scheer family that was flying from Maui to California. They say that they have given them a refund of their travel, and they have provided, Delta has provided, quote, additional compensation. No idea what or how much that is. I hope it's not a lot, because here's what's happening now. Everybody has a phone. Everybody is videoing every mishap, every inconvenience, and they're going to try and squeeze the airlines. Airlines are rich, and they'll continue to be rich, but nobody should be abusing the situation, and I think that's what's starting to happen. Poor Simon the Rabbit, you've been following the news. You know he was frozen and then cremated, and so they're going to sue over that. The owners of the giant rabbit.
At a news conference in Iowa, was it in Iowa this morning? Or
yeah, Des Moines. Sure, why not? Why was the news conference in Des Moines? The owners of a giant rabbit, is that where the rabbit was headed? I know it was coming to the United States. The owners of the giant rabbit that died after flying from London to Chicago want to know more about the animal's death.
I think they wanted it to be closer to the rabbit's family. It would be easier for them not to have to travel. I know it's just a hop.
why he was so quickly cremated. Attorney Guy Cook said Monday that the owners of the 3-foot-long rabbit, do we have to keep stressing the length or the size of this ridiculous rabbit named Simon? And really, when you give it a name, now it feels like it's more personal, doesn't it? It's not just a rabbit. It's Simon, the 3-foot-tall rabbit. Anyway, are troubled that he was cremated without a necropsy or post-mortem examination soon after his death, April 20th. A pet family employee opened the cage a short while later and found Simon dead. They said he was alive when he landed. Then he went to sleep, but he never woke up. The airline says they offered to perform the necropsy free of charge. The customers didn't want it. There's a disagreement over what happened there. You have this one. An Australian traveler is suing American Airlines, claiming that he suffered injuries after being seated next to 2 obese seatmates for a 14-hour flight. He says he's got nothing against the 2 large men on either side of whom he was sitting. But Michael Anthony Taylor, 67, told Sydney's Daily Telegraph that he spent most of the trip from Sydney to Los Angeles on an American Airlines flight, either crouching, kneeling, bracing, or standing. He claims the airline would not let him change seats, and the awkward position worsened his scoliosis. So he's suing American. And then there's the story from Newark to Paris of the United Airlines passenger. Actually, she was trying to go to Paris. She ended up landing in San Francisco. They change the gate at the last minute. That's happened to me before, too. And it's kind of a panic because you go, oh, no, wait, where? And then you're running to the next gate. The problem was that announcement was made in English, and she only speaks French. She got on the plane and noticed somebody else was sitting in her seat. It's because it was the wrong plane. The airline steward or stewardess who took her ticket and looked then found another seat on the plane for her, not noticing that it was, in fact, the wrong flight. So then she gets on the plane, and she went to San Francisco.
And you're saying that's on the passenger?
I think it is.
Oh, it is not.
It is.
You have to present. Why do I present my boarding pass to get on the damn plane in the first place?
I don't know.
What are they looking for?
Okay, I'll get you right, Steve. Let's do this. I will say shared responsibility, 50-50 final answer. You got on the wrong plane.
Okay.
You got on the wrong plane.
Right.
Well, I'm going to try that again. Wait. You got on the wrong plane.
But. If what's the security about? If I have to, I'm presenting my boarding pass 50 times, and what are they looking at? What are they looking at?
I don't know. What are you looking at?
Well,
I'm looking
at you now because I want you to tell me what they're looking at. I mean, if I present my boarding pass, I'm assuming they're checking the flight and my name.
Yeah. And finally, another airplane news. There is a lawsuit now saying that this is an appeals court, which is going to allow this to go forward, and this is against U.S. Airways. Lady pays her $15 bag fee, and then they lost her bags. She said, I want the $15 back, and they said no. In this case, I totally think they have to give the money back. The first court said, no, there's no implied contract here that we give your money back. It's a $15 bag fee to put the bag on the plane. If the bag never gets off the plane or we don't know where the bag went, that's on, you know, we still don't owe you the money. So she's suing. Listen to this. American Airlines alone in 2016 made how much money on baggage fees? You want to guess on that, Steve? How much money did American Airlines make in baggage fees last year?
I couldn't guess.
$1 billion.
Wow.
$1 billion.
And that's just kind of new revenue.
That's just like baggage fees. And so they don't want to have a case where lost or damaged bags mean you have to get money back. So they're fighting it, and now it's going to proceed, as they say. Boy, they should have given that lady the $15 and made this problem go away. It's 1:31. This is John Williams. You're listening to WGN Radio, and I'm sitting in the Allstate Showcase Studio on Michigan Avenue. Sun is shining. It's a lovely day downtown. People are dressed like they're going to a Northwestern football game, though. That's just the way it is. Just over my shoulder as I look out the Showcase studio window, I see the river. And if you take the river down towards, say, Union Station, there on the right is Trump Tower. And on Trump Tower are the big letters T-R-U-M-P. There is a firm in town that wants to float giant pigs in front of those letters so as to obscure the view. The person behind that is Jeffrey Roberts. He's the firm principal of New World Design Limited, an architect and design firm in the city. Jeffrey, welcome to WGN. How are you?
I'm great. Thanks for having me, John.
Is that a correct description of what's going on here?
That is. That's a good summary. It's an unusual project.
Nobody hired you, but you're an architect for hire.
Yes.
You're not a developer.
No.
You're not normally building your own buildings. Did anybody ask you to do this then?
No. This was done on our own initiative.
Your idea?
It was my idea. It was kind of a bit of office therapy after the elections.
So you weren't happy with how it went, and you thought, how can I strike back?
How can we contribute to the community that may see things in a little more rational way?
So this is about finding a way to make an anti-Trump statement, or is it a way to say something about the integrity of the skyline, which does not have those sorts of letters on them?
It's both. I wouldn't say that it's necessarily all about anti-Trump. It's speaking to a political condition, but it's also speaking to a design condition. It's out of scale. The sign is out of scale no matter what name would be on there.
Okay. So if we agree that was a blight just because of the size and placement of the letters, if those letters were O-B-A-M-A, would you be sitting here?
Probably.
No, you would not.
Well, listen, we've had a problem with it since it went up in 2014. Even before he was a candidate. The building is a lovely building. It contributes to the Chicago skyline. The River Corridor is a lovely corridor with great pieces of majestic,
especially now,
architecture. Right,
it's getting more beautiful all the time.
And it's really gleaming. It's beautiful. It's wonderful at night.
If you have not been downtown Chicago, from the lake to Union Station, it's amazing what they're doing. Now go down to river level, and there's a lovely path there paved with steps and fountains. People are jogging, selling hot dogs in the summer.
It's wonderful. It brings people down to the river, and it brings the river into the city, right? Rather than just being a gorge that goes.
And this was
through.
Mayor Daley's vision, right?
Yes.
Mayor Emanuel's continued with that. So was it Mayor Daley's administration that made the deal to allow Trump to put those large letters on the building?
As we understand it, the PUD, or the document that kind of set the development rights, was done by Daley. That's as I understand it.
And that was to get them to build the building. Sometimes you make concessions if a billionaire developer wants to build a building.
Correct.
So you want to do what again?
Well, we, from a design side, we've just felt that the sign was just too much. It's too arrogant. And regardless of the name, it brands that segment of the city. This is one of the most important and most vibrant sectors of the city. So what we wanted to do...
It's between the corncob towers, if you're not familiar with exactly where we're talking about, and say the merchandise mark, the Trump
sitting
Tower.
Right next to Bertrand Goldberg's masterpiece that's been there since 64. So we felt it was just a bombastic kind of sign. A lot of corporate owners will do a stamp of some sort, a badge on the corner of the building at the top in a very tasteful sort of way. That's fine. But to do essentially a mega billboard on the side of your building, it's not so good.
So how are you going to fight that?
So we looked at we did in our office what's referred to in the design community as a charrette. So essentially it's like a brainstorming exercise for creative people. So we get our trace paper out, and markers and pencils, and we start talking about design ideas. Initially we thought, okay, what kind of permanent structure could we create to obscure that? And that's not practical to do that, and it was a bit heavy-handed. And then my partner in the office had recently seen the graphics of the Pink Floyd album that was done in 1976 called Animals. And it had a giant pig floated above the Battersea Power Station in London. And we started talking about that idea, is could we float something in front of this? And then we kind of dug into the pig idea, and it had a lot of correlations. That album responded or was a kind of a musical interpretation of Animal Farm. We read Animal Farm. There was a lot of meaning in Animal Farm at this point in the political environment we're in. So we drew that correlation. And then we started thinking about, okay, what else can we assign to this that's going to be it's going to be rational? And we know that Mr. Trump has a taste for gold-encrusted interiors. And he made a comment in an architecture magazine about 6 or 8 months ago referring to it as comfortable modernism. And when we read that, we thought that was a bit humorous. So we made the pigs gold. There's one for each year of the presidency. They're pointing eastward as if they're flying to Washington. There was the Miss Piggy reference.
Piggy meaning Roseanne Barr?
Miss Universe.
Oh, yeah, right, okay.
Yeah, so that comment that was made during the campaign. So So we took all of these things and created what we felt to be a very, very highly rational piece of design.
Right. Okay, so there's more context than you might think if you just said, oh, you're floating pigs because that's a mean-spirited gesture.
Exactly. And while it has a little bit of levity, that is not what this is about, and it never has been.
Well, it's both, right? It is a mean-spirited gesture. You're flying pigs in front of his letters.
I say it is a statement, a design statement in response to the political environment.
How do you get the right to do that? I mean, you don't own that property, do you?
We're in a public way.
Okay, so the city then has to allow you to use that public space that way?
It's the river.
Yeah. The river. So, you're going to float them from the river.
From the river. So the initial concept, we said we're tethering these in the river. That's not practical. So what we did is we had an initial press release back at the end of 2016 and got overwhelming response. It actually made global news. So what we did is we went quiet on it. We went and did the engineering, the pragmatics, and looked at all of the things it would take to actually make this happen.
Right.
And we decided the most practical way to do this would be to float it off of a barge. So we took that. We looked at spoke with rigging specialists, spoke with balloon fabricators. There's an outfit out of London that's able to create these.
Right.
And looked at, spoke with our, worked with our structural engineers to rig a triangulated system. And it just kind of kept building on itself.
You're doing a GoFundMe page for this or a Kickstarter?
We have a GoFundMe page, and then we have our website that accepts donations.
How much is this going to cost? I see $450,000.
No.
$672,000.
No, thankfully not so
$78.
Much. $78. It's going to cost $100,000 for the components that we need to deploy it. There's a big question on how much security we're going to have to reimburse the city for, and we don't want to leave anybody holding the bag. So we're trying to navigate those waters and negotiate with the city.
Are you worried that the balloons will fly helter-skelter and start bonking things? Are you worried that somebody's going to get a 12-gauge shotgun and start firing at those because they don't like what you're saying?
Yeah. So we've thought about all these things.
Give me your answer to that in a minute. It's 148. Right. This is WGN in our studio. Jeffrey Roberts, firm principal of New World Designs Limited. They want to float 4 giant pigs in front of the letters TRUMP at the Trump Tower in downtown Chicago. Jeffrey Roberts is in our studio. He's with New World Design Limited. He's an architect, and he's the guy that wants to float 4 balloons the size of London buses above the Trump Tower sign, actually parallel to the Trump Tower sign, downtown Chicago, so as to obscure the view. Interesting point. You're only going to have it up there for one day. Your plan is to have it up there one day.
Absolutely. It's an art exhibit.
Why not longer?
It's not practical from the standpoint of the weather conditions and the float of these balloons.
So all of this, $100,000 plus a $250,000 temporary installment, what I'm reading here, currently funded, the goal is hundreds of thousands of dollars.
So it's $100,000 to deploy it. We don't know what the security costs are going to be. The GoFundMe page has called out $250,000 with the intent of traveling this. If we're successful in deploying it here, then what we would do is we would take it to Las Vegas next.
Oh, in front of another Trump property.
Correct.
And would you run it to Mar-a-Lago or someplace like that, or his New Jersey?
No,
place?
I don't think so. I think that the 2 or 3 icon properties would be interesting.
So this is performance art, essentially,
in a way. I mean, it's real. It's going to happen at a moment in time, and it's going to be there for a moment.
How much money have you raised so far?
We're in a few tens of thousands of dollars.
Okay, so say you got $25,000 and you need $100,000. When do you need to buy?
We would have to, in order to deploy this in September, we would need to have sufficient funds in pocket by the end of June.
Have you heard from Roger Waters?
No, we've communicated with his manager.
Pink Floyd.
Yes, and another member of his team. And, again, they put us in touch with the people that can make these for us.
They're endorsing. They're signing it off. They're not going to sue you for use of their trademarked pigs. Pigs, not donkeys. I mean, you explained the reference in the Orwellian notes and blah, blah, blah. But you could have just put up black squares, or you could have put up something more politically relevant.
Well, here's the thing, and this is a very important part of this. As you recall, in the front end of our discussion, I said that all these points led to a point of rational design. Part of this is about kind of putting that up as a direct contrast to all the kind of illogical things that were happening.
What does the city say about this?
We've met a couple of times with the city. Things have gone favorably. We still have some negotiating to do with them.
They're not saying no.
Nobody said no. Nobody said yes.
If they were going to say no, don't you think they would have said no right out of the gate? We do not want this headache.
Is this a reflection of Rahm Emanuel?
I mean, so there you have Rahm Emanuel, of all people, as the mayor of Chicago. So I can see why, while he doesn't strike me as a fun and games kind of guy, I could see why you've got a shot with Rahm Emanuel in office. Is this his call?
We have no idea who's seen this up the food chain. I don't want to know. We're going to go through the proper processes and do it in a very practical and
lastly, though, if we are all tired of the ugliness of the campaign and the divisiveness of the term, the Trump term, mm-hmm. do you worry that you're actually not making things any better? There you are now, putting pigs up in front of the president's name. Think of how much hostility, how much comedy, but also how much hostility that's going to engender.
Well, I go back to the fact that this is not all about comedy. Comedy is what you see if you don't read what we're putting out there. It has a much deeper meaning that is riding on the back of great works like Animal Farm.
And the message that your floating pigs in front of Trump's letters on Trump Tower is supposed to deliver is?
The message is about supporting the community that is kind of feeling a bit bewildered by the events of our current political situation. And that's the feedback we got from everything we put out there.
What's the date you want them to fly?
We would like to do it on a weekend in September.
You want pigs to fly, if you will, some weekend, undetermined in September.
Still being negotiated.
Okay, Jeffrey Roberts, fascinating, farcical, funny, and maybe important, too. I'll give you all of that. He's the firm principal of New World Design Limited. And we'll stay in touch. Good luck to you guys.
Thanks, John.
By the way, if you do want to make a donation to this GoFundMe project or Kickstarter project, where do I go?
Well, you can look at us on our webpage, which is flyingpigsonparade.org. Easy enough to remember.
Of course it is.
And if you look up Flying Pigs on Parade on GoFundMe, you'll find it as well.
Thank you, Steve Bertrand.
Thinking big thoughts so you don't have to.
All kinds of them.
Here's John Williams.
Thank you. It's 2:09. Mm-hmm. Hey, listen, lots of calls and texts in the last half hour. Our guest is in the studio talking about his plan to,
Lord have mercy,
fly pigs over the Illinois River, the Chicago River, in front of the Donald Trump Tower sign. I know a lot of people will really be offended by that, and I think some people will think that's the most perfect and wonderful thing. Off the air, I said to him, I can just imagine the crowd and the problems that this is going to create. And he said, yeah, that's one concern the city has. The city is, if not endorsing it, at least it sounds like the city is of a mind to let it happen for one day. But can you imagine if you had a barge with four giant balloons, each the size of, as they say, a London bus, floating above TRUMP on that tower? If that was there for one day in September, can you imagine the mass of humanity that would gather on the bridges, that would be floating in the river to try and get up close to it, that would be lining the, I guess, south bank of the river, or for that matter, the north. But, I mean, it would just be this fantastically large, dense crowd. A parade for the Blackhawks or the Cubs, you can stretch out, you know, from Wrigley Field to here, from Sox Park to here. You can stretch it out through Grant Park. But this is a rather confined space. So that's a concern for the city. Noam Levy is on. Stay tuned. Noam Levy is on a line. LA Times national healthcare policy reporter. He's joined us before. We asked him to help us out again today on WGN Radio. Hi, Noam. It's John Williams. How are you?
Good. How are you?
You have any vacation time? Do you want to come see the flying pigs?
Sounds exciting.
When pigs fly. Listen, Noam, yesterday and the day before and the day before, ever since the Republican House passed this version of a health care bill, there have been lists that have been coming out, alphabetized some of them, and very long about the conditions that if they pre-exist for you will either mean you don't get insurance or your insurance will be more expensive. And I mean, the list starts with acne. I'm wondering, can you put this in some perspective for us? Are we overreacting here? They're not going to deny you or charge you more insurance if you had pimples, right?
Well, not immediately.
That's not reassuring.
Well, I think the debate over this issue is real, and people, I think, should be concerned about the direction of the debate, although, as I said, I don't think anybody's going to lose coverage tomorrow. So let's back up for a second. John, you and I have talked about healthcare a lot over the years. As you know, it's complicated. I'll try to make it as straightforward as possible. But remember, before Obamacare, insurance companies routinely either denied coverage to people with pre-existing medical conditions or charged people more if they had conditions, in some cases as simple and seemingly even silly as acne, but also more serious, of course, cancer, diabetes, heart disease, et cetera. It was hard for folks who had those conditions to get health insurance. Obamacare changed all that. In 2014, new rules went in place that prohibited insurers from turning people down and, as importantly, prohibited insurers from charging people more if they had any pre-existing medical condition. So what would the House bill do that would change all that? Basically, the House legislation would give states, individual states, the ability to essentially get a waiver from some of these rules. So if Illinois, for example, or Wisconsin, which actually would be more relevant in this case, if Wisconsin decided that they wanted to get a waiver from these rules that require insurance companies not to charge people more if they're sick, they could get that waiver. And presumably then insurance companies in Wisconsin or Illinois would go ahead and decide, hey, if you have a history of cancer, we are going to charge you $5,000 or $10,000 more for your health insurance plan. So the issue is real here. Of course, there's a long way to go before what the House passed last week becomes law. So things may and probably will change. But as I said, the issue's real here. The debate is real. These are the kinds of things that are on the table.
Well, suppose I agree with the notion that if I have a history of arthritis and that becomes expensive down the road, an insurance company should have the right to charge more because they're almost certainly going to have to pay more. How much more then will my premiums go up? It sounds like you pulled $5,000 to $10,000 out of a hat. Would we see those sorts of increases?
We don't really know how much more insurers would charge. Of course, people who agree with this philosophy would point to auto insurance, I suppose, and say, yeah, you know, John, if you've had three car accidents in the last 2 years and I have only had one, you know, you should pay more for your auto insurance. So we kind of come back to a big philosophical question, of course, which is, do we want to have a health insurance system that penalizes people who have poor health, or do we believe that everybody should have access to health coverage no matter their medical history? I mean, that's a sort of high level kind of question of values, and you know, people disagree about that.
Well, I think the answer is that I think we've decided as a country that we want everybody to have equal access to health care. I guess the question, you're right, is, what is equal access, right? Should some people have to pay a little bit more? But I've seen tweets and I've heard stories from people saying $17,000, $6,000. I mean, really gigantic numbers for premiums, premium add-ons, additional premiums running to the thousands of dollars because of this House bill. Granted, it's not law, but I wonder if, does that sound plausible to you that they would go up that much?
You got to understand that before Obamacare came around, the way that health insurance companies made money selling health insurance to people on the individual market, people who didn't get it through an employer, was by excluding people who didn't have who had pre-existing medical conditions.
They wouldn't write you a policy. Right. Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say there were whole medical underwriting departments at, you know, health insurance plans around the country, because the number one job, if you were writing individual market health insurance plans before 2014, was how do you make sure that you don't have any sick people on your rolls, because sick people are expensive.
Yeah.
So it's not unrealistic, in my view, at least, to think that if health insurers were once again able to figure out ways to exclude people who are costly, that a health insurer wouldn't do that. You'd be silly not to if you ran a health insurance plan.
Well, I've been saying forever that Democrats aren't stupid and Republicans aren't bad. So why in the world, if it is as bad as Democrats and a lot of the media are saying, did the Republicans pass it? You know, the very fact that they did gives me pause, as if to say, if they were only interested in their careers, they wouldn't pass something as bad as what I'm reading. What's your take on that, Noam?
Well, I don't want to call one party dumb or
Well, but do you understand what I said?
Bad.
I don't think Democrats are stupid, and I don't think Republicans are bad. I think it can't be as bad as I'm reading it.
Well, I'll just tell you one thing, and I do think that this is instructive. You know, legislation gets written a lot of different ways in Washington, and a lot of people weigh in on it. There are good bills, there are bad bills, a lot of bills that are in between. One thing that I do think is notable about the House health care bill, and that I think folks actually should pay attention to, is the fact that notwithstanding the arguments that were made in favor of this bill, not a single major group representing doctors, representing nurses, representing patients with cancer and diabetes, heart disease, all these groups that represent patients, that speaks basically for patients or physicians, thought this was a good bill. Draw your own conclusions from that.
The Kaiser Family Foundation, that reports on health care like you do, estimates 52 million adults under 65 have pre-existing health issues. Everybody over 65 has got a pre-existing health issue. That's how they got to be 66. Everybody under 65, 52 million of us also have pre-existing health conditions. And then the list includes acne, anxiety, asthma, bipolar disease, depression, menstrual irregularities, sex reassignment, sleep apnea, transsexualism. I had a little of that, but it's passed now. What happens to pregnancy? Is a C-section or just a previous pregnancy going to be considered, Noam, in this bill, a pre-existing condition?
Could be. One caution I would put to your listeners, and you alluded to this in the lead-in, is that yes, there are. Let's take the Kaiser analysis for the sake of argument. 50 some odd million people under age 65 who have a pre-existing medical condition. That doesn't mean that 52 million Americans are suddenly going to find that their health insurance premiums go up because they have acne or because they had a C-section. So most of us get our health insurance through our employer, and most employers do not, the vast majority of employers do not charge their sick employees more than their employees without pre-existing medical conditions. So if you remain employed and you continue to get your health insurance through an employer, or for that matter, if you get it through a government program like Medicaid, you would not be subject to medical underrating under the House bill, most likely. But, of course, if you lose your job, you have to go out there and get a health plan on your own. It's under that circumstance that you might be exposed to what we've been talking about.
Well, that's not a small caveat, is it?
No.
That's huge.
No.
I mean, what we're saying is the vast majority of Americans, this will not apply to them, right?
It won't apply to their immediate circumstance. But remember, I mean, one of the things that the Affordable Care Act tried to do was to put a baseline protection so that if people did lose their jobs, and of course, in the last recession, which is when the Affordable Care Act was written, we saw millions of Americans losing their jobs and at the same time losing access to basic health care protection.
Yeah, that's true. By the way, there is one question when this comes up, far and away outpaces all the other questions. What would you guess it is from listeners? I'm looking at my call screen right now. It's very busy. What do you think the most common question is we get when this comes up?
I don't know.
Or comment. I have to take a commercial break. Can you come back and just answer this one most common question in a second?
Okay, sure.
Stand by. Noam Levy, who writes about health care for the LA Times. You read him in the Chicago Tribune as well. My number is 312-981-7200. This is WGN. Noam Levy's on the phone line. He writes about health care issues. You read him in the Chicago Sun-Times. You read him in the Los Angeles Times. You read him online as well. Noam, I'll put the caller on who has maybe the most commonly made comment about this health care bill. You ready?
Okay.
All right. This is going to be Marvin. Marvin, you're up. You're on WGN. Hi.
Hi. Thank you. What's upsetting to me, if I have the facts correct, is that Congress has a Cadillac health plan that covers them and their family, and there's no premiums for them, and it's for life. And while they stick the general public with real problems, they walk away scot-free.
Okay, let's see if that's true. We all want what they have, or we want them to have what we're going to get. Noam, talk about that.
Well, it's gotten a little more complicated because Congress did have to participate in the Obamacare marketplace. But one of the most controversial things that the House Republicans did initially when they wrote their replacement bill was exempt themselves from some of these weakened protections that they were prepared to.
No, they did not.
On everybody else.
Do not say that. They did not do that, Noam.
They did, and then at the last minute when they were called out for this, they passed a little patch to ensure that that was not the case.
So they are, in fact, going to have to abide by the terms of this new Affordable Care Act, huh?
Their American Health Care Act, they call it. Yep.
And do they have a Cadillac plan that they get for life that they don't have to pay for? Because that's not what we're getting.
They had very good health insurance through like every employer did, though they had to participate ultimately in a marketplace like folks who don't have employer coverage. They got coverage on the D.C. Health Benefit Exchange like folks in D.C. who don't have worker coverage, but they had good health care options. But
you understand what this is speaking to. They want them to not be able to sneak off with a better plan than everybody else.
Yeah.
And does this satisfy that? Or should we rest assured that they're not getting away with something here regarding that?
I think it's too early to know how that's going to shake out. Honestly,
okay.
I really do.
All right. Just a couple more real quick questions for you. A lot of people are saying what Mary is saying. Hey, Mary, jump in there. You're on the air.
Yeah. Thank you for my call. And this is great discussion. One thing that was commented on, and I don't think it's a great analogy, is saying people with people with car insurance can pay a higher premium because they've had lots of accidents, which that is true, and we should. Those people should pay a little higher premium when you're having accidents. But some illnesses, you don't have control over them. Like myself, I have MS. If I had to pay a higher premium because of that, I don't have control over it. It's not because I have a bad record. I don't have, I'm eating bad.
You didn't do anything to deserve this, yeah.
It is what it is, and some people with cancers and things like that.
Yeah, no, I get it. Talk about that, Noam.
Well, Mary makes, a very good point about a critical difference between auto insurance and health insurance. And clearly there are some medical conditions that are impacted by people's behavior, lung cancer for a lifelong smoker, for example. But there are many, many illnesses like MS, for example, and cancers or mental health issues that have nothing whatsoever to do with any personal choice that people made. And, as a society, I think we have to decide whether or not we're going to penalize people for their medical conditions.
I'm going to let you go, particularly since all of this might be moot. The Senate isn't going to pass a version like this anyway. They'll have their own bill. Am I right about that, Noam?
They will have their own version. I think it remains to be seen how closely it resembles what the House did.
Yeah.
But stay tuned.
All right. I'm going to call you again. Thank you, Noam.
John, good to be with you. Thanks.
You can follow Noam Levy at Noam Levy, N-O-A-M. Looks like Noam, N-O-A-M, Levy, L-E-V-E-Y, two E's in Levy, Noam Levy. You can follow him on Twitter. And also check out the Obamacare 101 feature on the L.A. Times website. We visit with Mary Wisniewski. She writes about transportation in Chicago. Did you see how many people got tickets for texting while driving last year?
It's in my headlines here, buddy boy.
It is amazing. It's amazing. Coming up. Thank you, Steve Bertrand. It is 2:39. This is WGN Radio. I'm John Williams. Ro Khan's around the corner. Ro with Anna DeVlantis. Will the beautiful weekend weather stick around? Tom Skilling has the latest forecast. They'll have a whole bucket of things to talk about. Steve, I know you did the news and blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, what was your favorite part, John?
Well, just what's the Sally Yates thing going on?
Well, so she's on Capitol Hill now. She's begun testimony, and she basically said that she told the Trump administration early on that she thought, and it's just going on now, but that she thought that the general, the former general,
Flynn,
had been compromised,
yeah,
and was subject to blackmail. Let me see if I can find a quote here for you. We haven't heard, I mean, I don't have the quotes yet. No,
but thing is ongoing, right?
Yeah. Quote from Sally Yates, we believe that General Flynn was compromised. Now, remember, she has an interesting sort of role in all this because she was essentially, she was the acting attorney general.
Right.
Because when a new administration comes in, the bosses go out and the staff sort of take over. So Sally Yates was acting attorney general, and she ended up being fired by the president when she refused to enforce one of his travel bans. So there was all of that going on as well.
So you think that compromises her view about General Flynn?
No, I'm just saying some people were calling her former attorney general, and, you know, technically I think she was, but she was an acting attorney general. I mean, she was never going to be around for much longer anyway. I'm not dismissing or any of it. I'm just trying to, you know, put in context what her position is there. Are you buying it, or what's your issue?
Well, I think everything you said is true, but I'm just wondering what the implication is. So by virtue of that, she's an outgoing, well, her boss was outgoing, and
right,
she's served there at the...
I'm not trying to make any implication, but I guess if I was, it wouldn't be like Trump firing Jeff Sessions, who was his chosen, sworn-in attorney general.
Right.
This was someone, a high staff, but a staff member, who had assumed the acting attorney general's post as the transition took place.
Well, at the end of the day, the question is she knowledgeable in telling the truth about General
Absolutely.
Flynn?
Right. Yeah, I'm not disputing anything like that.
Okay, so that's ongoing and will probably be a topic more for Roe after 3. Did you see Mary Wisniewski's story in the front page of the Chicago Tribune? Few curbs for cities' distracted drivers. So he said, what is the number of distracted driver tickets written in Chicago? And the number, it looks like a typo, doesn't it?
I was reading that while I was driving in this morning.
Sorry, Mary. She's sitting right here. She's right there and she can hear this. How are you, Mary?
I'm okay. Don't do that while you're driving.
But that's the problem. We'll get to that in just a moment. But if I may, you said that in 2014, there were almost 46,000 distracted driving tickets written. In 2015, there were almost 26,000. Granted, 20,000 fewer, but still 26,000 distracted driving citations. In 2016, the next full year for which we have numbers, there were 186. Boy, if you're one of those people, wah-wah. Why are you making that concerned face?
Well, it's a huge drop, and
it's a huge drop. It means they quit writing tickets.
They all but given up enforcing this particular city ordinance.
Why?
And this, how it was explained to me by Chicago Police spokesman Anthony Guglielmi, is that in 2015 there was a change in the law that made police have to treat citations under the cell phone ordinance the same as other moving violations, which means that they now have to go to traffic court and appear when the person who's going up there with their ticket is appearing. They used to just be able to not appear and the tickets could be upheld without them.
Like a parking ticket or
right.
something?
Right. So this is like requiring more of a police officer's time and,
right.
and attention.
So for that, he's got to now go to court as well. What a hassle.
Right. So obviously the Chicago police have a lot of other demands on them right now. They've lost manpower and they've basically dropped off by this huge amount, just an enormous amount on this issue. They do say they still care about it and they still want to enforce it.
If in 2016 they weren't enforcing distracted driving laws, did we see an increase in crashes or accidents as a result?
We saw an increase in crashes nationally. We saw a 14% increase in fatalities over 2 years, which is the highest jump in more than 50 years nationally. And we
overall, or just due to distracted driving?
Overall, and
really?
It's been linked to distracted driving. The National Highway Traffic Safety Administration looked at 2014-2015, where there was a big jump, and they found that deaths from crashes involving distracted driving were up 9%, which is more than for unrestrained passengers, speeding, drunken driving. This is going up with a bullet.
Well, but particularly
as a cause.
Well, I would be surprised if it went up at all for, say, unrestrained drivers. I think we got the message, wear your seatbelt. Young people and old people, everybody wears a seatbelt. I think we got the message about drunk driving, at least better than we did 20 years ago. We know not to drink and drive, have designated driver, take an Uber. But I don't think we got the message about texting while driving.
Right. People who are experts on this, including someone I quoted, Deborah Herzman, the CEO of the National Safety Council, said that people are very complacent about distracted driving. Everyone thinks they can do it safely. Everyone thinks, well, I made it home okay. I must be a great driver.
Everybody can do it safely. That's the problem, though. I'll take back what I said a moment ago, that we got the message about, we didn't get the message about distracted driving. I think we got the message. We know it's against the law. We know it's distracting. But we also believe that we can do it. And we can. Most people do not get in crashes. And most people text while they drive. I mean, that's the conundrum here, isn't it?
Right, it is. And, you know, people, you may think that you're a good driver when you're, you know, texting and driving all the way home and you don't get into an accident, but the person behind you who sees you weaving all over the road may not think so. And there have been spectacular, horrible crashes involving distracted driving. There was just that crash in Texas where the guy plowed into a bus full of church group and killing all these
people. He was texting?
Because he was texting, yeah.
The bus driver.
No, not the bus driver. A guy who was riding in a pickup truck and crashed into them. So it is the cause of spectacular crashes. You're taking your eyes off the road for an extended period of time.
And, you know, can you imagine how we change that?
One of the ways that we can change that is through technology. And one of the things I brought up in my article is a technology that a company is working on called a textilizer, which will be able to look at your phone's operating system after you've been in a crash. They'll be able to plug in your phone and see if you were just texting before or on the phone before a crash.
Okay, so we can prove that that was responsible, but that doesn't keep you from doing it.
It would keep you from doing it if you had the same kind of enormous penalties that you have against drunken driving, if they catch you with it.
But then that's the issue, isn't it? I mean, textilizer notwithstanding, what we need to do is then if we catch you with a textilizer, or we just observe you breaking that law, the penalty needs to be a lot bigger.
Right, right.
What do you guess on that?
Right now, the fines are pretty small. It's $50 to $150 for the state ordinance, $90 to $500 for the municipal ordinance. The fines for drunk driving are quite large, and you can get your license suspended. So the higher the penalties are going to be, the more of a deterrent it's going to have.
I get that. But, you know, this is my point. I know I sound like I'm being obstreperous here for no reason, but I'm not sure that everybody wants technology that keeps them from texting while driving. They want technology that keeps you from texting while driving,
right.
But I still want to check my phone on a sales call. And I think people would be sorry if either the technology kept them from doing it or if the penalty was so stiff that they themselves quit doing it. I don't even know if they'd quit doing it. I think they'd keep doing it and pay enormous fines, and then they'd be unhappy. Either way, I'm not persuaded that people want to stop texting and driving.
One thing that could persuade them is, you know, besides worrying about the fines or worrying about causing crashes and killing people, is a financial incentive. Some insurance companies are using telematics, an application that you put into your phone that tells you whether you're being a safe driver, whether you're braking harshly, whether you're using your cell phone, whether you're, you know, making, you know, sudden starts and stops,
weaving.
And I don't know if they can, but, you know, it uses your phone to do that. So it's actually using your phone to help you keep from misusing your phone. And you get a breaks on your insurance costs for using that. And that can be an incentive.
Really?
Maybe people won't recycle if they're doing it out of the goodness of their hearts, but they will recycle if they get a break on their garbage bill. It's that same idea.
That's an interesting point. But do you suppose there's any interest in, rather than penalizing us for using these things, make us better users of them? How about if we had technology that better enabled us to text while driving, voice to text, hands-free, stuff like that?
Unfortunately, John, the research suggests that hands-free is not that much better than hands-on. You're in the same level of distraction. When they do tests, they find that people, you know, using the hands-free application are just as distracted or almost just as distracted as people who are actually typing into their phones. So it's a big problem. I think one of the things that might have to change is just the culture, that when you're on the phone with somebody and they say, hey, I'm in my car, you can say, hey, you know, I don't really want to talk to you while you're in your car because you might get into a crash. But that's going to be a big culture change.
Remember the episodes of Mad Men where they'd be leaving the cocktail party or maybe a dinner party at Don Draper's house. And then his boss, Roger, would take a cocktail for the road, have one for the road. And nobody blanched at that.
Right. And think of, I mean, that wasn't that long ago.
Okay,
and there was that big of a culture change.
Right. So imagine now if when I called you and you said, I'm driving, I would go, oh, my God, hang up. And I would admit it the same way I would not give you a drink to drive.
Right.
We ain't there yet.
No, we aren't. But I think that, there's a lot of different prongs to this. There's public education. You know, you see this public service ads. Was this text really worth it? You know, you see a car splattered all over the road, and you have education. Young people, they have to get it through driver's ed classes, and it has to become culturally unacceptable. And more fines and more tickets could help too. But of course, if the police don't have the resources to do it, we're not going to get it.
Yeah, I think that's interesting. One, my only guess is if you're just going to fight fire with fire, that A, you've got to make it easier for the cops to write these tickets. They don't have to go to court. And number two, the fine has to be $1,000. And then people would still get them the first time, but I don't think they'd get them the second time. But I still think that they want to text, and it would be nice if we could find a way for them to do it. Oh, you got one more minute? You may have a question or comment for Mary. It's 312-981-7200. 312-981-7200. This is WGN. Mary Wisneski's in our studio. She is the transportation writer for your Chicago Tribune. In her page one story, Few Curbs for Cities Distracted Drivers, just talks about in the Tribune how few tickets the city's writing. It's too complicated for the cops these days. It burns up too much time to go to court. Off the air, you said that in Poland, what have they done?
In Poland, they have very strict laws against drunk driving, and which has really changed the culture over there. It's 0.02%, and people just won't dare to go out in their cars when they're maybe had even a little bit to drink because they're afraid they're going to lose their licenses and go to jail.
They're probably East Europeans. They're big drinkers, right?
There tends to be more problems with that there, and they really changed the culture with these with these laws. The phrase you hear over there is "Jestem samochodem." I'm in the car. I can't drink.
So the moral of the story is as addicted as people are to alcohol, so too are they their phones. But if the penalty is severe enough, then the driver won't do it.
Right. That there has to be, and that can help change the culture. It's not just education. There's all these different prongs. It's education, it's enforcement. And the deterrent of enforcement is really big. And this is what's lacking right now with distracted driving here.
Hey, Terry, you're on WGN. Hi.
Hi, great topic. I just had a question. When I was a kid, I built a radio, an RF jammer, out of a garage door remote, and I could jam all the radio signals in my house. I'm wondering why somebody doesn't invent something that we can put on every stoplight that within 100 yards of that stoplight jams your phone so you can't send text.
Wow, I think that would have some major consequences for emergency vehicles and stuff, so that might be the problem with that. It would interfere with emergency communications.
I guess so. I think the other problem, I like that, and that's a common consideration. Let's find a way to make it impossible through some sort of jamming technology. Isn't the problem with that, too, though? What about the passenger? If you're driving, are we going to restrict my ability to use my cell phone? And how does the jamming technology know who's behind the wheel?
Right. And a lot of it, they're just leaving up to the individual right now.
I'm out of time. All of our phone lines are ringing, and I know that you'll keep writing about this. Let's make more time for calls next time you come into the studio, particularly when you figure this out.
Okay.
When you have this solution.
I'll make sure I'll have the solution for everybody, and it'll just solve all the problems. Thanks very much for having me on.
How can I follow you on the Twitter, Mary? Do you tweet much?
I am at Mary Wiz Chicago.
W-I-Z. Mary Wiz Chicago, and it's Mary Wisneski, transportation writer for the Chicago Tribune. Nice to see you. Thanks for coming in.
Nice to see you.
The x-rays are negative on Anthony Rizzo's arm, but the problem
Good.
Is he died. It was 175-mile-an-hour fastball. How does that not kill a man?
I don't know. It looked painful.
Oh, my gosh.
And he was grimacing the whole rest of the game. I watched. I don't know what it is.
Rokan's in the studio. Anna DeVlantis, too. Hello.
Thank
Hi.
You. Hello. I watched the whole thing last night. I just started watching at 7 o'clock.
Let's give it up for
Rokan. Yeah, seriously.
Thank you.
Well done.
What time did
it end?
6.5 hours.
It was like
1:49 is when I went to bed.
Almost 2 in the morning, huh?
Yeah. And because, they were all featured on 60 Minutes.
Yeah, a friend
night.
Of mine texted me. She said it was just tear jerking. It was wonderful.
Mm-hmm. It was mostly about Theo and about the team, like his vision for the team, and then Joe Maddon and his vision. But they interviewed Kyle Schwarber, and they said, you know, he was like sort of the secret MVP for coming back. You know, he played in like three games all season, but he was the guy. And then Schwarber last night, so I want to, you know, watch the game. And then Schwarber was like perfect yesterday. I mean, he was just
couple doubles.
Yeah. And just
great
what,
catches in the outfield.
Exactly. Everything that he can possibly do. That one, right, dives into the stands. Just amazing. And that was a game. The disappointing thing about that for the all 15 of us who stayed up is that was a, that felt like a game of destiny. Like if they won that, then there's something destined here.
When they win the World Series, they're going to point back to that game.
The way that the 84 Cubs did to the St. Louis game at Wrigley Field. You know, sort of the same thing. But it didn't, well, it didn't work out
then.
And
out.
Maybe who knows what will happen now.
What are you doing today, my friend?
Let's see. Well, we have Mr. Sapelsa is going to join us about... A story tonight that he's doing on a reformed neo-Nazi and how a neo-Nazi is now trying to make amends. It's
so
a really interesting
story. Do we forgive former Nazis for that? Is that what happens here?
That was also on 60 Minutes last night. I don't think so, but we'll see. And then Washington Post Philip Rucker is following the Sally Yates testimony right now. We'll get the latest on that. You'll be in the 3 o'clock hour as well.
Okay.
Oh, and United!
Show.
United had another
Something
one.
Something new?
Yep.
There's another one?
There's another one. There's another one.
Is it the lady they sent to San Francisco who's supposed to go to France?
Oh, no.
So there's that.
What are the chances?
Oh, my gosh.
What are the chances?
On the upside, they didn't beat her up. So
yes,
there's that.
She's unscathed. She's
right.
Still in good health.
And she didn't die in a kennel, which is also why.